You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible, and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello. We're going to continue our study in Revelation today. We're going to be in the beginning of the seven trumpets. Now, we've seen the seven trumpets came out of the seventh seal. There's been a lot of conjecture about the relationship between the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. It seems to me there is a recapitulation. They're going over the same ground with greater intensity. Some have said there's a partial recapitulation in that the seven seals lead up to the beginning of the end, and the trumpets and the bowls describe the events of the end. Well, I can live with that, because what I think is the sixth seal is the end, the seventh trumpet is the end, and the bowls are climactic right to the end. Now, the question is then, where is John drawing his metaphors from? And almost every questionable metaphor will be pulled from one of three sources by commentators. Number one, they'll try to go back in the Old Testament and find an Old Testament allusion. And John, of course, alludes to the Old Testament over and over. In chapters 8 and 9, there's particular allusion to the Exodus plagues, to the book of Joel, chapter 2. And then always in John, there's an undercurrent of it's judgment, but it's judgment to turn man's heart back to God. Specifically, chapter 9, verse 20, and chapter 16, 10. God had a purpose even in this. And he broke the seventh seal, him being Jesus. Jesus breaks the first seven seals, but angels are the instrumentality for the seven trumpets and the seven bowls. And there was silence in heaven. Now, this silence has been greatly disputed. Some of the rabbis say that it was silence so the prayers of God's people could be heard because there was so much noise in heaven from all these angelic creatures singing praise to God. Well, that's possible. Some say no, it comes from the apocalyptic literature of 2 Esdras, chapter 7, verses 29 through 31, where silence introduces the new age. Possible, but I personally think the Old Testament is the place we ought to go. And there are several passages where silence, the symbol of the presence of God. God is in his temple, let all the earth be silent. That's the idea here. You might well see Habakkuk 2:20, Zephaniah 1:7, and Zechariah 2:13. And then I saw the seven angels who stand before God. Now the definite article is here in Greek, the seven angels. From Enoch chapter 20, verses 1 through 7, the seven angels of the presence in rabbinical Judaism are listed. And they are hugely important in these apocalyptic books. Now, they're listed there. Michael's one of them, Gabriel's one of them, and several other ones. Many think that the one who's in charge of Tartarus is the one that's mentioned in chapter 9. I just can't be sure of that. We see some of these angels of the presence from Isaiah 63:9 and a possible allusion in Luke 1:19 and the seven trumpets. Now, trumpets quite often are, in the Old Testament, a way of God communicating to his people in the sense trumpets were blown for religious purposes. Trumpets are blown for military purposes. Now, here's a few. Numbers chapter 10, verses 1 through 10, Exodus 19, 16 and 19, Isaiah 27, 13, Jeremiah 4, 5 through 9, Joel 2, 1 through 3, Zephaniah 1, 14 through 18, Zechariah 9, 14, again the intertestamental book of 2 Esdras, chapter 6, verse 23, and here's some New Testament allusions, Matthew 24, 31, 1 Corinthians 15, 52 and 53, and 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 are just some of the allusions to the idea of blowing the trumpet. Notice where it says in verse 3, then another angel with a censer in his hand. Now some say this is Jesus Christ. But again, this chapter, like the ones previously, some commentators make the allusions here to Jesus, and others make it to the evil one, like the star that fell in chapter 9. This is so fluid you can't lock it down. But I say to you, because Jesus is mentioned in verse 1 as he's not going to be called another angel in verse 3. In my opinion, this can't refer to Jesus. The only reason some commentators want it to is because they're nervous about the Bible teaching the intermediaryship of angels. And I think rabbinical Judaism does teach that, but this is not giving a biblical base for that. Now, this golden censer on the altar. Is this the incense altar? Yes. For sure, this is the incense altar here. We're not sure in earlier periods, like in chapter 5, verse 8, if it's the altar of incense or the altar of sacrifice. Chapter 5, verse 8 really is very similar to this account, where the four living creatures bring the prayers of God's people to God's attention. Here the angels do it by the Old Testament idea of putting incense. Now the incense was put on the altar of incense, and the smoke arose to God. You can look in the book of Leviticus over and over as a sweet savor arose to God. Here, it's the prayers of the saints. Notice it says, with the prayers of all God's people. Hallelujah. What an idea. I'm not sure who all God's people refers to here, but I want to tell you this. It does say that God's people affect God. You might want to see the beautiful passage of Psalms 141:2 here, where God's prayers of his people really touch him. And notice it says in verse 4, so the smoke of the incense went up from the angel's hand to the presence of God for the prayers of all his people. Many people make a very major interpretation point here that judgment comes at the prayers of God's people, like the souls under the altar we saw in earlier chapters. Now, notice what it mentions in verse 5, the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and flung it to the earth. Now, this seems to be very much like Ezekiel 10:2. And I think since these coals here, the coals for the altar of incense were taken from the altar of sacrifice. I believe there's probably two altars involved in this heavenly scene. And so this would be taken from the altar of sacrifice and flung down to the earth, just like Ezekiel 10:2. Now in verse 7, and the first one blew his trumpet, and there was a shower of hail and fire. Now, the next few verses are going to be a lot of parallelism to the Egyptian plagues. This hail and fire is much like Exodus 9:24. Some see an allusion here to Ezekiel 38:22, where Gog's invading army is destroyed by hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Maybe a possibility here. That may be another allusion. Notice where it says, one-third of the earth was burned up. Now, back in chapter 6, it was one-quarter of the earth. So you see the intensification from the seals, one-quarter, to the trumpets, one-third, to the bowls, total destruction. Now, this one-third is mentioned extensively in this chapter and on in the book of Revelation. So I've listed them all for you in your outline. Notice it says all the green grass was burned up. Well, in chapter 9, verse 4, it mentions don't hurt all the green grass. Now, you can't hold this apocalyptic language too tight. You can't lock it down like prose. And so don't get upset. What it may be here is simply the word one-third is meant to be applied to the vegetation as is to everything else. So the second angel blows a trumpet and a great mountain all ablaze is hurled into the sea. Now again, some go back to the Old Testament, Psalms 46:2. Others go to apocalyptic literature like the book of Enoch, chapter 18, verses 13 through 16. Or the Sibylline Oracles, chapter 5, verse 158. And so you see the different ways they're trying to get. Some say it's Mount Vesuvius. Again, those three different areas. Now, it says that they cast in the sea, and the sea was turned to blood. That reminds me of Exodus chapter 7, verses 20 and 21. And all the creatures of the sea died. That sounds like Exodus 7:21. Notice this great blazing star fell like a torch in verse 10. Now, some see an allusion here to the star back in chapter 6, verse 13. Some make an allusion to the star in chapter 9, verse 1. Again, these symbols are too fluid to lock it down just because the word star is used here and here. It's another judgment by these angels on physical creation to try to turn men's hearts to God. Now, it says the star is called Absensis. Now, that is, of course, the word for wormwood in the Old Testament. Wormwood is linked with idolatry in Deuteronomy 29:17-18. It's seen as a poison that will kill because of its link with idolatry in Jeremiah 9:15 and Jeremiah 23:15, and also in Amos chapter 6, verse 12. And notice the people die here. That shows an intensification from the seals where they're only tortured, but here they die. The fourth angel blew his trumpet. We've got a whole bunch of these Eschatological things happen like in the sixth seal. The sun, the moon, the sky is affected. There is no light. Now, this concept of no light is an Old Testament concept about the judgment of God. You might well see Exodus chapter 10, verse 21. Some go back to Joel 2:2 or Amos 5:18 for the idea of light as a symbol of God's judgment. And, of course, all of us know about Calvary, how the darkness came from noon till 3 to show that God turned His face away from His Son. Another New Testament allusion will be Mark 13:24, and you might want to look that up. Now, in verse 13, we have an interlude like we did back in the seals, and here we have an eagle flying through heaven. Now, King James has angel, but that's a very inferior manuscript from the 9th century A.D. The Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus have eagle. Now, it could be a vulture or it could be an eagle. Now, some say it's going back to the Old Testament, Job 39, 27 through 30. Others say, no, it's Ezekiel 39, 17 or Habakkuk 1, 8. Now, there are many possible allusions in the New Testament about vultures connected with God's judgment, Matthew 24, 28, Luke 17, 37, and even this interbiblical literature, this Jewish apocalyptic, 2 Baruch 77, 19 and following. So you see there's many possible allusions. That's, it's going in midair. You know how eagles and vultures kind of soar real high? That's the idea. We see this same midair in chapter 14, 6 and 19, 17. So it's flying way above the earth so all can see it. And the eagle talks. Now, obviously, this is symbolic of the eagle talking. Some say the eagle is a symbol of the Roman army. I think that's reading way too much into this. It says, alas, alas, alas. Now, this seems to be connected, the fact there's three great woes to fall on mankind left to go. We see these woes in 9:12, 11:14, and 12:12, and they're to fall on the inhabitants of the earth. Now, again, the inhabitants of the earth are used in the book of Revelation for unredeemed mankind. Chapter 3, verse 10, 6:10, 11:10, 13:8, and 12:2 are the same phrase for unregenerate humanity. Now, in chapter 9, we have a specific reference, either again in the plagues of Egypt, Exodus 10, 12 through 15, or from Joel chapter 2. And I personally think Joel chapter 2 is a better setting, though with the Exodus plagues in chapter 8, it's not unusual they would be continued in chapter 9. Thus, the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and a star that had fallen from the sky. Now, here's the idea of had fallen. Perfect tense. It had already fallen. Now, some link this to Satan, the angel that fell from heaven. And they go back to Isaiah 14:12, or they go to Luke 10:18, or they go to Revelation 12:9 and say, see, it's Satan. He'd fallen to heaven. But in context, it seems to me that it's just another angel that's in charge of God's judgment. Now, I agree that down in verse 11, he's going to be called the king of the abyss. It seems like the same angel. But again, God is in control of these things. It's not that Satan has a control over these demonic elements that are going to be loose, but God's in control. He's in control of the four angels that are bound, the river Euphrates in verse 14, and he's in control of this angel that fell. So I don't personally see it as Satan, but you can see how obviously fluid these metaphors are when it can be Satan or another angel of God. Now, the star had fallen from the sky, and to this angel, the keys of the pit of the abyss were given. But this idea of the key to something is mentioned in chapter 1, verse 18, where Christ has the keys of death and Hades. And the idea of chapter 20, verse 1, where another angel has the keys of the pit. Now, this abyss, in my opinion, is synonymous with Tartarus of 2 Peter 2, 4. And I want to show you why. The abyss is basically a Greek word which means depth with the alpha privative. Which means fathomless, okay? And you might well see Genesis 1, 2, and 7, 11, where in the Septuagint this word appears. In Romans 10, 7, it's used for Hades or Sheol, where the dead go. But in other parts of the Bible, like Luke 8, 31, that's the Jesus sending the demons into the pigs count, it seems like it's a place where these evil spirits are kept. Matter of fact, in Revelation 11, 7, it's where the Antichrist comes up from. In Revelation 21, it's where Satan is bound. So I think Tartarus, which is where the angels of Genesis 6 are held in darkness, I think it's the same allusion to the place where fallen angelic spirits are kept, and that's what the abyss is. Now, notice it says, was given. Now, there's a bunch of passages through here, passive verbs. I've showed them in your notes where those passive verbs in chapter 8 and chapter 9 show that God's in control of all things. He's in control of earth history. He's in control of fallen angels. God is sovereign. He's in control. And boy, for a group of hurting Christians, that is a wonderful truth that's emphasized over and over and over here. Now, so he opened the pit of the abyss, and smoke, like smoke of a huge furnace, puffed out. Now, some say this means that there is fire in Hades or Sheol. I'm not sure we can buy that. Luke 16 talks about the rich man was in punishment in Hades, so there is the idea of punishment and fire even before hell, but we're not sure how much we can back up here. Now, the smoke comes out, and out of the smoke comes these locusts. Notice that the air was darkened. Now, some say that's refers to Satan, the prince and the power of the air. I think that's reading way too much into this here. Out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, but the power was given them like a power of earthly scorpions. Now, this to me is not looking for something literal to be fulfilled like this. This is a demonic horde, half animal, half insect, look like human faces that are going to torture men. They're not regular locusts. They're scorpion locusts, and they're not supposed to eat grass. They're supposed to torment men for 5 months. Obviously, to me, this is the intensification of demonic activity before the return of Christ. And that's going to be also followed, even in more intense form, by the horses with serpent tails and breath like dragons in the second half of this chapter. So here these supernatural locusts come upon men. They're not to eat plants, what that normally locusts would eat in verse 4, but only the people who did not have the mark of the seal of God on their forehead. Now, this is the 144,000 mentioned back earlier. Those who have been sealed, God's people. These plagues, this is not the great tribulation on believers. This is the great tribulation of God on unbelievers. And one reason it's so confusing is we're not always certain when the word tribulation is used which one we're referring to. There are two different kinds. Now, notice where it mentions here, they were not permitted to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. Why 5 months? Well, some say it's the life of a locust, maybe. Some say it's the idea of limited judgment. Now, that may be true, because back in chapter 6, verse 6, chapter 6, verse 8, chapter 8, verses 7 through 12, there is a limit to the judgment of God that fell on these unbelievers. Maybe the idea of 5 months is another half of 10, or half of completion. And the torture was inflicted on the torture of a scorpion. Now, this idea of scorpion may be a metaphor. You might want to see 2 Chronicles 10, 11 and 14, about an Old Testament metaphor for the sting of a scorpion. And the people will look for death, but will not find it. Go back to chapter 6, verses 15 and 16, where the same allusion is brought. And they will flee, and they'll look to try to hide, but they can't hide. And the locusts look like horses. Now, many go to Joel chapter 2, verse 4 here. But I want to say to you, it's quite possible this is an Arab proverb. Let me read this Arab proverb to you. Locusts have the head like a horse, a breast like a lion, a feet like a camel, a body like a serpent, and antenna like the hair of a maiden. Now, that's an Arab proverb, but it sounds like the description here. So I think John is just drawing from the cultural definition of locusts as part human and part animal. And you can read through here. The deal, the lion's teeth, Joel 1, 6. Their vast numbers like chariots of horses rumbling to battle, Joel 2, 4, and 5. And then it says their tails were like scorpion. And again, they had 5 months. Now, verse 11, it says, and they had over them a king. Now, Proverbs 30, verse 27, says that locusts don't have a king. But this is a really important point here. In Hebrew, his name is Abaddon, and in Greek, Apollyon. Now, in Hebrew, it means destruction, but in Greek, it means destroyer. It's masculine. Now, some go back to the Old Testament, Job 26:6, Job 28:22, Job 31:12, Psalms 88:11, Proverbs 15:11, Proverbs 27:20, to speak about the illusion of this Abaddon. But others go to the Qumran literature, or this interbiblical literature, where it's this name is a personification of death. Still others see it as a reference to Domitian and Nero claiming to be the incarnation of Apollo. And they see the same root, Apollyon and Apollo, came from the same Greek root, and they see an allusion here to emperor worship. Now, it's also known that a locust was a symbol of Apollo. And so maybe that's true. It was saying that who claims to be emperor is really only emperor over a group of demonic locusts. Maybe that's the idea, but it may be reading too much into it here. Then the sixth angel blew his trumpet, and I heard a voice from the corners of the altar. Now, from Exodus 30, verses 2, 3, and 10, the altar of incense had horns, and that seems to be this altar, though it could refer to the altar of sacrifice that I think mentioned earlier, where the souls of those who died for the faith were under it. Here we have the idea of God's people now, their prayers are what's going to affect the judgment that follows. Turn loose the four angels that are bound. Now here, are these just more servants of God? Well, the fact there are bound angels seems to tell me they're fallen angels. Now there's four of them, seems to link with the four horsemen of the apocalypse back in chapter 6, verse 2, through 8, and chapter 7, verse 1. Now I realize the fourness are in different places, but the four, the idea of universal problems, seems to be the key here. Okay. At the river Euphrates. Now, this river Euphrates was the ideal limits of the people of God. You might want to see, I can find that reference here. I believe it's Genesis 15:8, Deuteronomy 1:7, Deuteronomy 11:24, and Joshua 1:4. It's Genesis 15:18, excuse me. It was the farthest limits of the promised land. Now, some who are looking for historical allusions say this refers to the Parthians, who were on the borders of the Euphrates. Now, that they go back to chapter 6 and say the bow was the weapon of the Parthians. The horses were the way they were used to it. They were mounted archers, and Rome was afraid of them, and their hair was long like the antenna of the locust. Maybe so, but I think we're reading too much in to this if we make it say that. And the four angels who were kept in rebellion for that hour and day and month. Notice the hour. And it's the idea of something very specific. In Enoch chapter 92:2, it talks about how God's in control of every event on earth. I think that's an illusion here. God is in control even of this demonic persecution that's coming upon unbelievers. The number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. Now some say it's a demonic horseman. Modern dispensation tries to make it the army of China, but I really think it's demonic angels, and it's like an unnumberable host. Myriads of myriads is the idea here. Okay, all the troops involved in the Axis and the Allied powers in World War II was 70 million. Do you see how astonishing a number 200 million is? And in my vision, John's almost saying in verse 17, this is visionary, this is not literal. The horses and horsemen look like this. He describes them. It's almost like the horsemen and horses moving or to one kind of piece, and the armor is on both of them. Some say, the Parthians look like this, or the Persians look like this. I think we're reading way too much into this. These are symbolism of demonic hosts that come. Notice they've got three colors. They're red, blue, and yellow. We're not sure if it's different ones or different colors, or they're tri-colored themselves. They're going to kill a third of mankind by these three plagues, fire, smoke, and sulfur. That's where the three colors come from. Power was given them, and the power of the horses. Now, the horses are the ones that do the killing. It's in their mouth and their tails, serpent in their tails, fire out of their mouths, and that's what they kill with. So it's obviously not literal here. Snakes in their tails, some say, well, it's the Parthians braiding their horses' tails. I think we're reading too much into that. Though it may be a background, like the idea of Apollyon meaning Apollo. Maybe there is a historical allusion, but I think it goes far beyond that. And notice in verse 20, and the rest of mankind who were not killed by the plagues did not repent. They were meant to repent. There was a purpose in this. It's redemptive, but they wouldn't turn. They kept worshiping demons. You might want to see Deuteronomy 32:17, Psalms 106:37, and 1 Corinthians 10:20, and 1 Timothy 4:1 about the demons behind idol worship. I don't think idols are anything, but the demonic uses that to trick men and seduce them. Notice the mention in verse 21 of murders and magic. You might want to see Galatians 5:20. It's the word sorcery. We get the English word pharmacy from this. And here we have idolatry and immorality and thefts. It shows the things that humans wouldn't turn to. Now, to me, it's very important we see that what we have here is a demonic invasion just preceding the end time. But listen to this, friends. These things could not hurt the people of God. Those persecuted Christians that were being killed by the synagogue of Satan, and those who claim to be teachers but aren't, back in the letters to the seven churches, they were going in persecution. They were being persecuted by unbelievers. But God says there's a persecution coming, a persecution on unbelievers that you won't be affected by. I'm in control of history, he says. Trust me, I'm going to bring all things to light. I'm going to make things fair. I'm going to make things right. I'm in control of history. I'm in control of evil. I'm on my throne. The prayers of my people affect me. I know what you're going through. I'm going to bring it all right. Trust me. Hang in there. That seems to be the real word. Whether we can analyze every one of these allusions, whether we can be certain exactly what John meant, is not as important as that we see the overall thrust. God says, I love you. I'm in control. Fear not, little flock. I'm going to bring it to pass in the appropriate way. That's a message we all need to hear, whether we're in the midst of persecution or not. God's on His throne. Heaven is silent. His people affect Him. God will judge the unbelieving world. God's going to bring history to a culmination. Boy, what a great message. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.